17th. This is our second session with George Rathman, Leo Slater, and David Brock.
Well, some questions I'd like to ask you about have to do with your involvement with the bio organization. And I understand that from my reading that you became involved with that organization in 1982 or thereabouts. Is that right?
When it started. It was not my idea. It was Ron Cape, who was one of the pioneers in the business, Cavasidis being one of the first biotechnology companies, and he was the chairman. And he felt it was appropriate to start to organize an association. I wasn't sure what the association should be doing or could be doing. I was very busy. It was the first years of Amgen, so I selected one of the people on our staff to participate on the board. And was not very active, therefore, the first couple of years when that person was there representing us. But he left us, I think, in 1983 or 4, and that's when I became involved with the board. And after a few years, when they were looking for a sequence of potential heads of the association, mm-hmm. I got in line, so to speak, and I served my 2 years, I believe, in 1987 and 88 as chairman. Continued to be on the board most of the time since that date, although right now I'm not on the board. There's always a kind of a cooling off time after you've been on for a long stretch, then they take you off for a little while. And right now I'm on one of those vacations, but I have been associated with the bio since the beginning, and during the 2 years that I was chairman, I was really very active. And the main opportunity for someone to do this is that they get themselves exposed to things that otherwise they'd never have access to. I was meeting with congressmen and staffers and understanding the whole political process by necessity as the chairman of what that time was called IBA. And that's a real opportunity, and I certainly was grateful. In turn, you begin to serve. You really can carry some weight. I mean, really carry the mail for the industry, because meeting with those people is essential for them understanding. As I mentioned in the talk today, for example, talking Dingell and Kennedy into the fact that they didn't want to have price controls was a long task, and a lot of people contributed good thoughts and good ideas, and lobbying, which is basically what we did, has got kind of a bad name. Everybody assumes that you put money in the hands of guys and you get them to do wrong things. Lobbying that we were doing was what it should be, is you're giving an education to these people so they fully understand the consequences of a new piece of legislation that could be very damaging to your industry, and if it's damaging to society, they should be careful about it. And that's what we did with Dingell and Kennedy. And there were other times that we interacted very strongly with Washington, and it became a major activity, particularly in the connection with the FDA. And some significant advances were made during that time. And to current time by interacting and trying to show the FDA where some of the problems were. And Kester was quite amazing, because he'd say, well, I don't believe that's a problem. And he'd say, well, come on, let's go through the facts. 10 years ago, there weren't products being put on clinical hold. There weren't any disasters. Why do we now have products going on clinical hold all the time? It's because conservatism had been allowed to creep in, and people just deciding that don't take any risk instead of weighing risk-benefit ratio. As soon as he became really fully aware of his own history, which he hadn't been aware of the history of the FDA, he could realize that things had gotten a lot worse without his knowing it, because he thought things were improving. So it was an opportunity to share information with the people that were determining the destiny of biotechnology. And it was very satisfying when they seemed to reorient themselves, as he did to some degree. But unfortunately, they made some changes, and then they began to feel that the changes are, that all had been done, and the job was over. I really don't.
Do you think that
hair in my mouth? I have to get it out of there. I don't know. I got a little bonus from one of those.
Do you think that the experience of you and your colleagues in bio was as much an education for people in the biotechnology industry about government bureaucracies and the political process as it was for the politicians?
I think it was, yes. I think,
yeah.
And one of the reasons that that's important is that it takes an inordinate amount of patience to present information to people that you feel are antagonistic. If you begin to understand their antagonism, you have an incentive to say, let's share information, maybe we can talk them out of it. But your first reaction is, I don't want to waste my time with those people. They're wrong-headed, they got wrong views, and the heck with them. And that doesn't accomplish anything. So I think we were all educated that we saw the need for understanding the viewpoint of the government people, and the need for patience, because they truly were not very well informed. That's true. And there was the feeling that you could see some progress when you did inform them, and so you set about the rather difficult task of making sure that. And you listened too. Then they were there when they had views. I think they were actually right. I think that when they said that you can't have national health care without price controls, I think they were right, because I think if you're going to pass the money out to cover every possible cost, mm-hmm. and people then can run the costs up because there's somebody there to pay for it, that's a really serious problem. But it would be paying too much for price if you put in price controls, because now you've destroyed any element of the free enterprise system that relates to health care, and the free enterprise system works. So you have to think about it the other way. How do we preserve the free enterprise system rather than how do we reduce health care costs? Because you want to do the two together, not one and not the other. So I think we recognized the problem more than we ever had before, but we still weren't sympathetic with the idea that a ready solution is to just put in price controls. You can control the prices any way you want. Matter of fact, you can completely eliminate the cost of any new drugs, because there aren't going to be any. You're going to run the companies out of business. And in most cases, new drugs do. I think we could show them that new drugs save money. The drug component of the healthcare package was 7%, which was a shocker to most congressmen when you tell them, you're looking at 7% of the problem. If healthcare costs are too big, you're looking at 7%. And you know what percentage of the problem you're looking at when you look at biotech product healthcare costs?
Right.
You're looking at about 8% of 7%. So you're down there under 0.5%. And you think you're solving the problem by putting in healthcare, putting in cost controls or price controls on biotech products. It's absurd. It's just plain absurd. So it isn't going to solve the problem. But not only that, I can show you the direct relationship between the opportunity to make money in the biotech industry and the opportunity to do it. Because if you can't make money, we're not going to get investors.
Right.
It's questionable sometimes as to whether with a large pharmaceutical company that there's a direct relationship between their profits and what research programs they're able to initiate. But in the biotech company, there is a direct relationship with the money they can raise in financing and what they can accomplish. And if they cannot finance, they cannot do anything. They're out of business, because they don't make money until they've got a product on the market. So there was a lot of education. I think we also began to understand the other views. I certainly understand the views of the FDA a lot better, because I can see the pressures that are on them from all different sources. And that's why I often feel, and it's a role for Chemical Heritage among others, there's a role to keep public education in mind all the time, because if the public moves off in the direction of a risk-free society, the FDA has no choice. They have to go toward risk-free behavior. And risk-free behavior, which does not weigh benefits, will always lead to the same thing. You would not inject a patient with anything, saline, for heaven's sake, if there isn't an upside. So if you don't look at benefit, you will do nothing. You'll just stand absolutely still. And the medical equation is particularly serious, because you can picture almost anything going wrong with almost anything you do, and you have to be weighing the benefits that could happen. And that's our job in starting a clinical study, is to show the FDA that the probability of a benefit is pretty high. And then when we begin to see those benefits, then we expect them to weigh the risks of continuing with a program in which we've got very good evidence we're going to see a benefit. So once you accept the fact that they're constrained by those kinds of parameters, you can still try to attack the idea that risk-free doesn't work, and at the same time be sensitive to the fact that they got a lot of pressures on them. So I think we learned a lot. I think bio has been very effective. I sure hope they can do something about the current threat of price controls, because I think it's not a pleasant experience to wake up this morning and find out your stock has dropped 20% while you're out of town one day.
Yeah.
So that's a big hit. And there's a lot of investors. I'm going to be hearing from them. They're going to say, what's wrong with the company? And in almost every case that our stock has taken a hit, it's been an industry issue, not a personal company issue. Though we're just as susceptible as any other biotech company. If you have really bad news, you're going to take a hit. But it's particularly painful to keep taking hits that have nothing to do with the performance of your company. And it's what happened in 1994. And as I showed today, it's a steady downward trend in stock price for everybody, so that you were almost unfinanceable by the time you got to the end of the year.
That covers sort of the regulation component of the world that the industry operates in. When you were, well, during your time with Bio, were you involved in any activities on the public perception side of things, sort of like...
We had several ventures, and some of them were successful and some of them weren't. At that time, it was clear that we had a mission, a good mission, but maybe an inappropriate one. We had a mission to educate people about biotechnology, and one of the approaches to that was provided by some of the PR people from Monsanto and DuPont. They were very sophisticated PR people. They said the thing to do is to put together videos that would be professionally done, that would tell the biotech story and make it clear how benign it was as a technology, because people were afraid of it, mm-hmm. and how beneficial it was at its best when it did good things. So let's put together these videos and let's inform the public about how wonderful it is. And we'll make these videos available to schools, and this must be a problem you people encounter all the time, because it sounded very attractive. So we had a budget at that time. I hate to speculate, but I know it's infinitesimal compared to the budget at Bio today. It was possibly $800,000 or $900,000 a year, covered everything we did, or something like that. It was a really modest budget. So you're going to allocate a few $100,000 to public relations. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't do much with that beyond just having some publicity. But what you can do is you can say, well, let's tax each of the participants in Bio to produce these videos that we think would be educationally important. And there was no doubt about it that one of the reasons to support that, if you were Monsanto, was you were going to get a little message in there about some of Monsanto's products, and there'd be a trailer at the end that say, generously supported by blah, 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 and Monsanto. So it was reasonable that you could collect special funds in this way. It was very tough for us at Amgen. We were losing money every month. We didn't have a bankroll of any kind. We didn't have a cash flow that was positive. And the idea that we should help participate in funding these public relations documents or videos was very difficult for us, but we tried to do our share. But what they tried to do was, they told us that it cost you, and if I get the numbers wrong, it's only my inadvertent error. So let's say it's going to cost you $200,000 to put on one of these things, and it wouldn't come out of our standard budget because it wasn't big enough. So you wanted to allocate $200,000, and you take each of whatever it was. We didn't have 100 at the time, but you might have 50, so if you had 1,000, it would be $200. You might be able to do that. But when you got 50, you're talking about $20,000 a person or something like that,
right.
And maybe $10,000. And so you say, well, some of the companies couldn't afford anything. So you're trying to dig into your pocket for $10,000, and we tended to do that. But we got an education because I was simultaneously attending pharma meetings, Pharmaceutical Manufacturer Association mm-hmm. meetings, PMA it was called at the time. And they were saying, if you want to do a public relations job, be careful. That's expensive. What does it cost to impact the habits of a housewife? $50 million. How much money do you have for your public relations? You're going to reach John Q. Public or Mrs. Q. Public. You've got a few $100,000. You aren't going to reach them. It is not possible. Well, you guys are very pessimistic. I mean, we don't have to have $50 million to have a massive PR campaign. And they said, well, then don't try it. Well, I thought, that's a defeatist attitude here. We want to affect the public opinion, and you're telling me, give up, don't even try. And they said, no. They said, but there are opinions you can affect. You can go after the key decision makers in Congress. You can go after the key targets in various types of activities, such as the FDA. Mm-hmm. And you can start an information campaign to affect those people that are very important to you. You can also develop coalitions or consortia or some type of alliances, so that you don't try to do it alone. You take the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association along with Bio, along with maybe chemical manufacturers or somebody mm-hmm. else. And if these are fairly well represented in the mission you have, and they all have similar behavior, so you don't want to take somebody along with you. The nuclear power people would probably not be a good choice because they're probably more resistance and enthusiasm. But if you could get at least four or five organizations, so you multiply, you're leveraging what you're going to put in. You're going to be careful to address the most significant populations, not just John Q. himself, and you're hoping that this is going to rub off in benefits to society that then the average person will get an awareness that biotech is doing well. So we learned a lot about that, and have evolved into an organization that I'm not that close to anymore. As I say, I'm off the board right now, but fully recognizes the realities as well as the opportunities, and the realities are pretty tough. It's pretty hard to just, in fact, one of the things that was a generalization in my mind was the most effective PR that we can put together is getting companies to be successful in launching products that treat patients, because it is so dramatic when they can have a friend or a relative who's going to gain the benefit. And I mean, in these things, it's like a word of mouth publicity campaign, but it works. I mean, I get people walking up to me today when they recognize who I am or they know where I came from, and they'll tell me I saved their life or I saved their mother's life or we impacted their quality of life to the point where it's changed everything about how they live. And you know that it's a far better, it's a very effective, and when you don't have to really spend all that money, you're doing this anyway, you're trying to put products on the market, just recognizing that when those products go on the market, the kind of publicity they're easily going to extract right out of the media for the fact that good things are happening will take care of reaching the public in many ways. And so I've felt for a while that it's probably the most single most important type of information exchange relates to our successes. In other words, when we started addressing these things back in 1984 and 85, I gave a speech at the Brookings Institute, and I thought it was a good speech. It was on the promise of biotechnology. We were saying, here's what it's going to do. And I think because I was careful in how I did it, and I took information from all the existing biotech companies so I could talk about the potential of tissue plasminogen activator and about plant genetics and about a dozen or more different potential products that were getting close. It was effective, but when you're able to talk about results, it's much better. If you can talk about results, I think it's a terrible waste of time to have a lot of publicity about what biotech's going to look like 150 years from now, and maybe when the intersection of biotechnology and computer science gives us a brand new dimension in medicine. I think that's really very ineffective. I think that tell somebody that we've cured a lot of people of anemia or that we've made big advances in cancer, and it has a message that everybody relates to. So I think that that's one of the other things we learned, is that maybe our very successes were a better way to really impact cross-section of society. So, and if by taking your PR program and addressing Congress and opinion leaders and decision makers in the government, that would facilitate the approval of the products that are pending if we did it right, and that in turn would then impact the society by an indirect way. And I think we came up more or less with that conclusion. We did put those videos together. They were very good videos. I still have them. They're very impressive. They were well done. They've kind of proved to you that genetics is an old thing and we're not doing something new and horrible. We're doing just a little more of what we did before and in a more controlled way than conventional genetics. And they were really well done. But I suspect that their impact was very minimal. And the number of videos that were distributed and how to get people to buy them, and if they didn't buy them, how you finance the distribution. And we thought we had a liquidating program in which somebody would take on the job of getting them distributed for a modest amount of money. It never worked. It just cost a lot of money to get them out there into the schools and so on. And the schools didn't exactly know what to do with them. So there was that whole program was more educational than it was useful. Educational for us, again, rather than
right.
People we're trying to hit. So that's still a big issue, and I sympathize with the mission of the Chemical Heritage Foundation in trying to say, let's help people really understand and get good feelings about science, and every little thing that can be done is important. And the younger the people are when they get that message, the better off we'd be. But it's really a difficult job. And hopefully biotechnology helps, and the sort of science that's going on helps, because we do have this other thing going in parallel where people are so impressed by the fact there's a drug to treat a problem that before previously has been totally untreated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's compelling, that what's going on in science is a good thing. And bioscience is certainly a great way to move ahead as far as things that are good for society, good career paths for things, good kids, good ideas for kids to think about, and the whole thing feeds to a positive result. But the direct effect on the entire population is something that's just about impossible to implement.
I had just one other question about bio, and that was, were there Were there sorts of questions that you and your colleagues were addressing about the industry itself, about maybe rules or standards, things like that, industry practices or forming a real cohesive sense of a industry community
There's some internal education programs along those lines. Mm-hmm. Because the different status of different members of the association, some of them have had many products that have gone into clinical testing, some have many that have been on the market, and it's relatively easy, and Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association done it for years, to set up workshops, and you kind of bootstrap yourself. You have some formal individuals invited because they're very knowledgeable, but you also have participation by the haves to talk to the have-nots yet, and that's constant. So how to make sure that you dialed in enough good manufacturing practices but didn't have the overkill that might be disabling? What are the common practices? What are the best practices? Right. What sort of safety precautions are desirable and necessary and should be endorsed? And so there's lots of internal guidance from associations like that. The only thing that's not shared is anything to do with pricing. Of course, if you have to take on the government that's going to put in price controls, that you can do. But what becomes a very difficult subject once in a while is that the subject of how a biotech company decides its pricing. And that's always great concern about potential antitrust. And of course, it seems like an absurdity. You have a group of companies who collectively lose money, and you kind of think it's a strange quirk indeed to say, but they may be so powerful that their power base is going to threaten objectivity and all the rest of this. It's really kind of unfortunate, but it really is. It is not necessary for an association to go ahead and discuss pricing, and I can see why there's a great sensitivity, and so that's a forbidden territory. But helping another biotech company in any other way is absolutely appropriate, and it happens. In fact, we actually have a lot of relationships with pharmaceutical people because there are many common members, and there'll be information exchanges across that interface all the time. So there's huge value in these associations. And of course, it has the very desirable purpose that if you're going to argue with the FDA, no single company, well, I do it all the time because I got to know them pretty well, and the people think I'm kind of reckless, but in reality, no company ever wants to take that chance. They're just afraid that if they start to let the FDA know that they've got serious objections to the way they're doing things, it just sort of sounds as though what's going to happen is you're going to get on a blacklist, and there's somebody in that FDA is going to make a decision against you for the sole reason that you've given them a big pain in the neck. So it's much better if you're going to have a confrontation or discussion that it be done by the association, and they can just simply say, is there an area here that we need to have attention paid to this, and there seems to be some concerns, and that's a pretty good system, although I say it isn't impossible to do it on an individual company basis. It's probably healthier to do it that way. So there's lots of benefits, and I think what I find is the biggest benefit is that when you're confronted with a lot of arbitrary decisions and price changes in your stock that you had nothing to say about, you get to feeling like you have no control of your destiny, and so the natural instinct at that point is to complain. But complain to whom, and what does it do, and it doesn't really accomplish anything. A much more fruitful line is, what are we going to do about it? And an association can help you focus on the solution to the problem rather than griping about the problem. And I think it's wonderful. And when I hear people complain, I say to them right away, are you a member of the association? Why don't you get active in that association? Why don't you use that association to approach who it is? Is it FDA? Is it HICFA in reimbursement? Is it the Congress? Just use the association and share your time and effort with them, and it'll be multiplied many fold because there are others that could do it, and third parties speaking on your behalf are very, very effective. The lobbying, in other words, that was done, and I mean proper lobbying, mm-hmm. in connection with the patent system, the regulatory issues with the FDA, the finance issues, and how to maybe get better consideration of these companies who giving them a tax break in most cases doesn't do what you might think. In one of those testimonies that I had, Dave Pryor said, well, just how much have you gotten from the government in financing your R&D anyway? I said, nothing. He said, would you answer that question again carefully? I've asked you how much you've gotten. Don't forget about tax breaks. I said, we lose money. We don't get any benefit from a tax break. We don't pay any taxes. And as far as the other things that we've raised all our money from private investment. The government hasn't funded our programs. We don't have NIH grants in our company. The government has not put money into Amgen in those days, ICOS to this day, still true. Well, that was a big revelation. I mean, it just had to be that. But there are certain tax considerations that are worth talking about. There are R&D tax credits, which ultimately will affect you in the future when the time comes that you're going to make some money. And so it isn't like there aren't some benefits there. That the tax issue that probably is the most significant for biotech is that they keep toying with the idea of a capital gains tax reduction. And want to do it in this way or that way that's going to be just right. It's so simple in my mind that if you ask somebody to make an investment in a biotech company, and if they hold it for 5 years, and it's a high-risk investment in a small company, where's the harm in giving them a break in terms of capital gains? It can't help but stimulate more investment in biotech, and the actual amount of dollars involved is, and it's proven to be, a very, very small number, and as a matter of fact, because there will be eventually capital gains anyway, even if you delay it and you reduce it. Mm-hmm. If there were more investment in very successful businesses, there's more taxes. The businesses pay taxes on their profits, and the individual investors pay taxes on their gains to some degree, no matter what. So it seems like it's a pretty obvious place to expand the horizons of a biotech industry. But my own feeling is, if I had to ask for something in the government, the first thing I'd ask for is reduce barriers and not necessarily give me tax breaks, because I think tax breaks give a wrong message to society that they're subsidizing businesses and businesses therefore are manipulating the government. So I just take away the barriers. Take away the barriers in international trade, very important. Take away the barriers in regulatory situations. For a while there was the possibility that there would be dual regulation of biotech, and it still occurs once in a while. You have the FDA, which is a mighty force, and you got EPA, and all of a sudden someone's trying to say, well, you got to get your product approved by the FDA, but you got to have your process examined by the EPA to see that you're not environmentally hazardous. Well, it was clearly an overkill in many ways, far beyond what anybody might have imagined, and that has so far not happened, again, by sharing information. Mm-hmm. and recognizing that the FDA knows full well what's safe and unsafe in what you do, and good manufacturing practices are in fact safe practices. So it's taken care of. We don't need an overlap of the regulatory agencies, and so those kinds of issues are extremely well directed, addressed by associations.
Did you have any other questions about bio? I just had one follow-up, which has the relationship between the PMA and or the pharmaceutical manufacturer.
Oh, no, called pharma. Yeah.
Pharma and bio moved closer. Has that relationship increased over time?
Basically a strong positive relationship. Yeah. There are times that kind of shake you up when you have the feeling that your ally, pharma, is not your ally, and it's not. You never feel like they're wrong. If they're not your ally, they're not your ally. And the only thing is, you have this concern as to where that might emerge sometime when you least expect it. So you're trying to streamline the FDA. You sometimes have the feeling that the biotech companies that are have-nots are far more dedicated toward letting new products come out faster than the organizations that have all the products. And there are times when individual decisions do smack of being in conflict with the way bio would have liked to do it. But that's a small price to pay for a relationship that overall does an awful lot of good. And one of the places where a pharma is so much more sophisticated in having struggled with many of these issues for 20 or 30 or 40 years, however long it's been. I know it's been at least 25 that I've been associated with pharma one way or another. I've been associated with 35 years. So I know that they've been around a long time previously, the PMA. And they are very savvy about when the government is putting its nose under the tent, so to speak. So it would be tempted to say, oh, that's not really a problem yet. That's not really a problem. They're only doing this and this. And now they're only doing this, this, and this, but that's still not really a problem. It's not impacting us. And pharma is very quick to say, no, wait a second. If we ignore the steps that are being taken, we could be leading to a very serious problem, and we better take action now. And they're good at anticipating where some of these problems could go in very serious. They were the first to indicate that the so-called innocuous prescription drug benefit, that would be, what a good thing for everybody. The government's going to pay their prescription drugs. They could see that one coming right away because they've been there a few times. And that is, hey guys, there's a certain sequence of events that are going to occur here. Number one, they're going to offer prescription drug benefits to everybody, so they have all their drugs paid for. Then once they have all their drugs paid for, the way they're going to get that through is they're going to say it won't cost that much. Then they're going to do it. Then they're going to measure how much it does cost, and we can estimate it's going to cost tens of billions of dollars. This idea is not going to cost much. It's absurd. So now what happened is you went ahead because it isn't going to cost much. You found out it costs a lot. There's only one thing left to do, and that is have price controls to keep the cost from going up. And it's all going to follow like night follows day. And you go through that a few times, and you watch what the history tells you, and you say, watch out for that one, because as much as we like to see everybody get a drug benefit, and certainly we hate to see it that people can't afford a particular drug, but the solution that says, let's have our health care bill go up by a factor of 10 and no one's going to fuss over it, that's a terrible solution because it's not going to happen. So that's where the pharma people help the bio. Bio, on the other hand, is much more dedicated toward change than pharma is, and that's something you got to watch out for. So sometimes status quo is a little too acceptable for bio's taste, and then we take slightly different views. But I think for the most part, they're also very sensitive to their obligation to keep the other party informed. Mm-hmm. So if they're going to take a stand that's a little different from what they've heard from the other side, that exchange of information is very important, so you aren't zigging and zagging and then getting pitted against each other. And I think it's been very, very successful the last 5 years.
Well, I think then I would like to move back to some questions about the early days at Amgen, and the first question that I had about that period was in the 81-82 period, when staffing is starting, the organization is being set up. I wanted to know what your individual role was in designing how the how the company would be organized and structured, and what was it like trying to staff this new organization?
Well, first of all, in general, I followed the kind of the precepts of 3M that the smartest people in the business are not necessarily the guy at the top. So if you analyze what's needed in the way of knowledge, you find out that in the case of Amgen, your scientific advisory board was a reservoir of incredibly insightful science. So you better listen closely to what they can tell you about how to do the scientific approach and where the opportunities are and where the things are riper to move ahead into something else. In terms of structuring the departments, hey, these are academics who have put together a large number of different departments around the country. And so if you're going to do something practical, and they didn't know how to do that necessarily, but they were quick to suggest that you don't just want molecular biologists. Those are the people that splice genes. You're going to need a combination of biological backgrounds. You're going to need some biochemistry. You're going to need diagnostics. You're going to need immunology. You're going to need monoclonal antibody capability. You're going to need this, that. Well, of course, it's very easy to list a lot of things you need. It's harder to do it, but at least you're aware now that you're not just going to hire. My first idea was I'm going to hire a bunch of molecular biologists, because I was at Abbott. They didn't have a good enough team on molecular biology, and they didn't do decent recombinant DNA. So that's what I want, recombinant DNA. Mm-hmm. But when you're setting up a separate company, it's actually different than doing it in Abbott. In Abbott, you had the biochemistry, the organic chemistry, the analytical chemistry.
Right.
Here you have to be careful. You don't just have these poor lone rangers in there, the molecular biologists that can't go to anywhere to get the things they need. So they advised me right away, now wait a minute, it's not going to be all molecular biologists, and they were right. And so we had quite a cross-section that was sort of laid out by semi-formalized planning, saying, well, let's get three of these, six of these, five of those, and then we'll see what we can do. We set about right away to use the scientific advisory board in recruiting, because we figured it makes a difference if you get top-notch people, reasonably top-notch people, or average people. And so we went after the very best that we could, and we had the scientific advisors screen our candidates in the best way you can, which is they pick up the phone and they call their colleague at Harvard or at Princeton or somewhere else and say, what do you really think of this guy? And I don't want the BS that says he's better than average like everybody else you turn out. I want to know, you see, and you got the right answer, so that we had a very careful screening process for putting these people together. And then I'd run them by the scientific advisors and have them meet them personally And the reason for that was to say to these young people, yeah, you're scared to death that this company's going to go out of business. I think worse things could happen to someone than finding out that you've impressed Lee Hood or Marv Carruthers or Arnie Berg or mm-hmm. these people you met in the last 24 hours. If you do a job, and we happen to have a tough time, you're still going to be intact all the way with respect to your professional career because you're going to be impressing these people. They're on our board and they're terribly interested in what's going on in the science of Amgen. So we were able to get, as far as I was concerned, it was a rare day when we got turned down by somebody that we thought was first rate. Yes, I remember the disappointment about the second month. The guy that I thought was very good said, no, I want to go to DuPont. Well, why do you want to go to DuPont? Because it's safer. DuPont's going to be around for another 50 years. I don't know that about you. And I gave him the pitch about the scientific advisors and the whole bit. He went to DuPont. And then I, of course, have to say to myself, well, maybe he's not the right kind of person for biotech. Oh, he could have been a great guy. I don't know. But you tend to go after him really hard when you know their records are very strong. And rarely there people would you'd get that problem. I had some others that cropped up. There were times when they were worried about who they'd report to, and you didn't know who they were going to report to, and you have certain uncertainties. But eventually you develop a cadre of people that are very, very good, and the people that are coming in and interviewing realize, hey, those are good people, and I'm going to be part of a great team. So we had a very high success ratio. Thousand Oaks is a good place to recruit to. It's a wonderful community, and so is Seattle, by the way. But the crime level in Thousand Oaks is about the smallest in the country for its size. It's got an incredible climate. Now, there were a couple people turned me down because they were sure we were too close to the smog belt. I wasn't able to get people from Northern California. They hate Southern Californians. I was quite astonished at that. Found out that it was hard to get people out of Boston or some places on the East Coast because they didn't like the culture. The Midwest was hard because sometimes, I mean, we did very well, but these are all issues. The Midwest, sometimes a fellow would come out and you'd say, well, this is really wonderful. I would like to live in California instead of Kankakee, Illinois or something. And they'd say, well, how about housing? And whereas I had enormous difficulties recruiting at Abbott people from California, I found out that recruiting people from the Midwest into California was almost as hard mm-hmm. because the person would say, well, I've got 2 acres. And I got a 4-bedroom house, and it cost me $48,000. And I look around here, and it's $300,000 for anything that I could possibly live in. What am I going to do? You know, what am I going to do? Well, I gave them some front-end bonuses once in a while, but I had to keep things pretty well appropriate. I couldn't just go off the deep end. So we missed a few like that. But I'd say we got at least 9 out of 10 of the people we looked at. And we had the combination of the board and the things we were doing and a good track record for if they checked me out back to Abbott or back to 3M, I had a pretty neat reputation, so that was helpful. And then as we built strong members of the staff, they were lightning rods for getting more and more good people. So the way that you actually allocate resources has always been an interesting issue among people because everybody wants to know and they think there's some magic secret. And I suspect there's a lot of magic here because you can do it wrong. But there are a few things that are terribly important in my mind, and one is that you make sure that the people that have an assignment like their assignment. So you're very reluctant to start shifting people around because you know so well that that's a bad program, that's a good program. You go from here over to there. Mm-hmm. You're far better off to recognize that you shouldn't take that responsibility, you shouldn't take that authority, you shouldn't take that power. You should get him on the wall telling you how great it is to go over there. And that program is very exciting. And you pull him rather than push him. And the push just doesn't work. The guy's been out of shape. He feels like he's got pushed around. We practically never did that. Well, the question is, how do you terminate a program? Well, pretty carefully. Because sometimes persistence, as the question was asked today, persistence could be the way you get there. And somebody who wants to have persistence, you better be a little careful about derailing him because he's in a bad program. He might be right. It might have, it might be a good one that he thinks he's about to get some daylight in. So you got to be careful about that, but you also have to be aware that it's far better off to attract him into something than to push him out of something. And it's not that hard because most of the people are alert enough to see that program is moving ahead very rapidly. This one hasn't made that much progress. In fact, we've had a couple of setbacks, and there's no obvious way around these setbacks. And so you do it somewhat more cautiously than might sound appropriate, but I think it's not a difficult job to allocate resources. Hmm. It's not a difficult job. It's just you have to do it with a certain amount of consistency, and you have to do it with thoroughness and attention to the individual attitudes of people. And if you If you err once in a while that someone stays on a program that does fail for a little too long, I don't think it's worth the pain of trying to hit everyone at the very first moment you know it's in trouble to try to pull somebody out, because some of those do recover, and you're better off to give a little slop in the system. And that's really one of the keys that I learned at 3M, is that intentional slack in the system means that the guy is not held to every second of every day that he's going to be working on this program. He's got this latitude 3M called it 15% of his time. It's a lot of time. We don't have a formalized 15%, but you let there be slack in the system so that the guy can try something that he's intrigued by, can even do parallel studies once in a while because he doesn't know which one's going to work. And you allow a lot of that stuff because fundamentally there's a divergent or creative dimension to science that you just can't. You can't predict precisely the right single path to be on. And to allow for that, you allow people some latitude and some slack so they can do kind of lateral exploration once in a while, divergent thinking and so on. So it's really not a difficult job once you get used to the idea that you're not a genius and that you can't dictate precisely what people should be doing and that you're going to have some inefficiencies. And mostly you're going to hope that people are worried, are so excited about their program that they're going to be they're going to generate their self-pressure. You're not going to put pressure on, because pressure has a very negative consequence. In order to really make pressure stick, you almost need a punitive step at the end of the line. I'm telling you I want that by July 1st. I'm telling you I want that by July 1st. Oh, July 10th. Whap, I got to hit you with something. So once that happens, you decide the next time you're not buying into it. The next September 1st date, you're going to say it can't be done by that time. And none of the forecasts are accurate anymore. They all get slop in them to the point where you can't get on top of everything. So you have to say, I want you to work as hard as you possibly can to hit that July 1st date, because remember this, he's dependent upon that date, because when you get that molecule on that date, he's going to start his studies, and that guy's dependent on his. So it's really important to try to hit that date. But you tell me what went wrong when it goes wrong, and you tell me how you learned what you've learned, and we're not going to go back and beat up on you. We're going to just give you some more time. And I've even gone to the point of saying, you hit your goal last year. Your goal was to have that before the end of the year. By golly, you got it on December 41 or December 52nd or whatever. That's pretty darn good. And we even pay off at some of our incentive programs to say, hey, that's good enough. And Swanson didn't do that, by the way. The guy that ran Genentech, he refused to make allowances for any kind of slack. And he ran a great company, so there are other ways to do it. He felt that dates are dates, and you got to hit them. And he was also trying to make a profit every quarter. In a company that has no products, the way you do that is you have to hit milestones that you're going to get payoffs on. And if you're going to make a profit in the quarter when you're in that early embryonic stage, that means if you got a way of getting a collection in December, you're not going to hit that quarter if that collection comes in January. So Swanson would say, you know, you don't have a choice. You've got to hit that December date, and I don't want anything later than December 31. That's the latest I can go. So he differed from me. I didn't care that much whether I made a profit every quarter. I had the feeling that if I wanted to do the right thing, I had to make a bit of an adjustment over that idea that I could predict my income stream or cost stream so perfectly that I know exactly what's going to happen every quarter. So we didn't make a profit every quarter. He did. He was very successful. He was by far the most successful company until Amgen was more successful. Now, whether that was partly because Amgen had a little more flexibility, I don't know. We were lucky too. I'm sure that's all part of it. But I think that there's a very careful thing is to avoid fear. That was in one of the things that we heard all the time at 3M. We don't want to have people afraid to do things. They'll never take risks if they're fearful. And fear is a lousy motivator anyway. I mean, it's a tremendous motivator, but it usually channels you along wrong directions and gives you a terrible outlook. So it's a terrible way to run a company. So we don't want to be that demanding that we end up with fear. We do want to set a very high standard of excellence. And lots of ways of doing that. We did at ICOS, we did it in a way that was different from Amgen, in the sense that we had a board of directors that were just preeminent in their background. We didn't have a preeminent board at Amgen. We just put various people, mostly venture capitalists, on our board. Mm-hmm. But at ICOS, we ended up, by virtue of a strategy to get a really preeminent board, we had to exchange.